that mic towards you, then you don't have to lean in.
You can actually hear me.
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
I was telling the listeners this morning that you were late because you witnessed an accident, and I said I hope that it wasn't a severe accident and injuries. No?
No.
Okay, good.
One of those things they used to call fender benders when they still had fenders.
Yeah. Yeah. And now those fenders cost a ton, and they're made out of plastic.
Yeah.
Right. Senator Durenberger, I just had a it's really funny. I just talked to Mark last week.
My brother.
Your brother Mark, yeah.
Oh, my God. I talked to him last week, too.
And I'll see him tomorrow.
You will?
Yeah. Are you going to go to the memorial for Earl Buchan?
No.
Okay. Well, it's tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Up at Northrop Auditorium.
Uh-huh.
You've been there, I'm sure.
Oh, yes.
I don't think I have, and I'm going to leave early so
Earl
I can get
Buchan.
In there.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. Oh, man, what a guy.
Oh, jeez. Amazing. For those of you that aren't aware, he was the founder of Medtronic, mm-hmm. one of the most generous firms in America, period.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the way down here, I really have to admit that I didn't get a chance to grab your book and read it before you got here.
Oh, shame on you.
I know. I apologize.
No, that's all right.
But
You're busy.
We have a woman by the name of Terry Knight,
mm-hmm.
and she's a news director, and she's also interviews people about their books, and she does it by phone, so
really?
It's very convenient. And I'll mention that to Terry, and maybe she can call you up. And
do a phone interview?
Yeah.
She's delightful.
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be great.
She records them, and they're played back at 11 o'clock
yeah,
this
Terry
morning.
Terry Knight.
So,
great.
Terry Knight, that's a lady that brought you the water.
You know most of that history anyway.
Yeah, I know. Say, where were you in 1959?
I was, when you say the day that I think about graduating
from
law school.
Law school, all right.
And getting my first job, you know, with the Levander Law Firm. And that's
mean
all
like
the rest is history since then.
Harold Levander?
Harold Levander's law.
South St. Paul?
South St. Paul, right.
I had him on the air on Thanksgiving, 69.
You're kidding. When he was governor?
Yes.
Yes.
And I had a turkle gobbling contest where people would call in and do a gobble, and I'd record it, and then
right.
I'd play them back during newscasts and pick out the winner. He didn't win, but he did gobble like a turkey, and he did a good job on Thanksgiving morning, 1969.
The governor of the state did a good job gobbling like a turkey.
Yes.
Look at that. Even in those days.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking there's so many things that pop up into my mind that I totally had forgotten until we started our conversation. What years were you senator?
I was elected in 1978, filled the balance of Hubert Humphrey's term, which was the 4 years that he had left in his term when he died.
How did that happen?
It happened to me because I started running for governor. And I was running against a local boy here by the name of Al Quie, who decided he didn't want to be a congressman anymore, but he would be willing to be a governor.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people who thought at the time that a famous name is better than a relatively unknown name thought Al Quie should be the governor. And Dave Durenberger ought to just say goodbye to politics. And then Muriel Humphrey, who was holding the job on appointment from Governor Purpich, who replaced Governor Anderson, who went to Washington as the United States Senator that same year, to add to the confusion of the times, Muriel decided she didn't want to run for re-election in November, which she was required by a new law that had been recently passed to do. So at that point, these Republicans said, hey, Dave, we got Rudy Boschwitz running against Wendy Anderson. He's got a good chance of beating him because Wendy looks like a self-appointed senator. You know, a governor who got himself elected or got himself appointed by his lieutenant governor, who became the governor when he quit, blah, 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 to make this more complicated.
No, it's
yeah,
fine.
And that left good old Dave, you know, as the sort of the third party in this little play, because I was doing pretty well against Al, but clearly not getting ahead of him with the party people and so forth. And so they said, Dave, you run for the Senate. And I said, I don't know the Senate. I mean, the Senate is Hubert Humphrey, or it's Gene McCarthy, or it's Fritz Mondale. You know, this is in my time.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think of it. And so what's with this Senate thing? I can understand Rudy, because, you know, Rudy is is ahead of Wendy right now. I can understand that one, but gee, Hubert Humphrey, what is this? So, what they did was persuade me to go to Washington D.C. and talk to some senators about the Senate. I did. They asked me, every one of them asked me the same question: why do you want to be a governor? And I said, because I want to change the role of government in the lives of people. And they said, well, then you better come to Washington, because that's where all the money's going. And if you remember those days, inflation was almost clearly out of control by 1978.
Oh,
the
yeah.
price of everything's going up, including your taxes.
Interesting.
And so there's a huge amount of money flowing through the federal income tax system to Washington, D.C. And they said, you want to change the role of government, you come to Washington. That's where you do it. And that's what persuaded me to do it.
But, you know, when you talk about that, this community, as you know, is liberal. And even the state senator races, the Republican may win the office, but they don't win Northfield. So when you're talking about your background there, you mentioned a whole lot of people that are Democrats, and yet you're a Republican. And you kind of got your start as a Democrat. How did you switch parties?
I didn't. I started my start as a Republican, what I call a progressive Republican.
Okay.
In those days, that made a difference in Minnesota, because people were interested in how did you look at the role of government in their lives? You know, what should it be doing? What should it not be doing? And that was appealing. And at the time, the Democrats, my good fortune, I suppose, Democrats had a primary contest on their side between Don Fraser, the very liberal congressman from Minneapolis, in the 5th District, and he was being challenged by Bob Short.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the famous
that.
Bob Short.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to take the...
He's associated with the Twins and the...
Yeah.
Movers and shakers of
the
Twin Cities.
Yes, he was moving and shaking a trucking company, made a lot of money on it, and he moved the Washington senators out of Washington, D.C. to Harlingen, Texas, and then they eventually came up here. And I don't know, this, I may have that one wrong in sequence, but Bob was a much more conservative Democrat, and he ended up beating Fraser in the Democratic primary by about 3,000 votes. So I ended up running against Bob. And as I recall the figure, I got something like 60% of the vote, which I might not have likely gotten against Don Fraser. So you never know how these things happen, but that's how I got there. And then when I got there, there were 12 of us that year. Excuse me, there were 18 of us new senators that year. So I took office within 2 days, and I was 82nd in seniority in the United States Senate. And 6 months earlier, four months earlier, I had no idea I'd ever be in the United States Senate.
And how many terms did you serve?
Served 3 terms.
Three.
The balance of Hubert's first term, and then 2 on my own, in starting in 1982, and then again in 1988.
One of the favorite sons from Northfield was Paul Wellstone, the late mm-hmm. Wellstone. Did you ever have an opportunity to work with him, talk to him, advise, or dissent?
Sure. Paul was defeated Rudy in Rudy Boschwitz in 1990, and I had 2 years into my third term, having beaten Skip Humphrey in the 1988 election.
Yeah.
So Paul came to Washington as a big surprise from Minnesota, when I had 4 years left on my term. And my recollection is, it took me about the first, as it did everybody else, it took me at least a year to get used to Paul Wellstone. Because Paul Wellstone was one of those what you see is what you get people. He did not believe he was actually in the United States Senate. I mean, it took him a long time to really get it through his head that being a Paul Wellstone, just as he was, could actually get him elected statewide. He did it as much, I think, as a protest. We can do better than this kind of a campaign. And particularly in his first 6 months there, it was like, where the heck am I? I mean, what am I doing here? The next 6 months, interestingly, Paul discovered that if you play by the rules and you make everybody play by the rules, you can start to change the way the Senate operates. So Paul would go to the floor when the majority leader in those days, Democratic majority leader, George Mitchell, was trying to get a bill done like they're doing this week in the last week of a session for something. And Paul would get up on the floor and object to unanimous consent to move to that particular legislation. Why? Because it had just been, he'd just come from the committee to the floor that day, and he'd never had a chance to read it. So that was his rationale. He said, wait a minute, wait. There's 100 of us here, and nobody's had a chance to read it except a handful of you guys, and you want us to vote on it. So he just refused to give unanimous consent to consider the bill. Well, that went on, or then they'd have to talk him out of it, or, you know, back down, take the bill down, and start over. And Paul did that until the leader of the Senate, the Democratic leader of the Senate, got it through his head that this is a man who simply wants us to play by the rules. So it wasn't so much, I want, you know, an extra 3 days as the laws of the Senate require to read a bill. It was, hey, there might be some stuff going through here, you know, that all of us would love knowing what we're doing before we are asked to do it. And from that point on, Paul became an influence on the way the Senate ran, interestingly.
Yeah.
And from then on, say after that first year of his experiences, Paul was one of the senators. Yes, he was far to the left of most of them, including the Democrats. But his ability to reflect what he felt, what he was experiencing, what he believed, you know, enhanced the whole body, as a matter of fact. And that's the reason why at his memorial service at the University of Minnesota, you know, everybody in the Senate showed up. Everybody.
Wow.
Literally, they sat up there in the stands, and a lot of tears were shed. There were Republican tears as well as Democratic tears.
Well, that brings back memories for me. The first time he was elected to the Senate, he was with me in my Bronco. And it was like 9 o'clock in the morning, and he had come out to the. I had picked him. I don't know how it ended up, but anyhow, he ended up in my Bronco, and we were coming by between the athletic field and Carleton campus on 19 going west, and the phone rang. Well, at that time, the way things set up in my truck, it was a radio telephone.
Oh yeah.
So you would take. You would hear it come over the radio, and then you would speak into a microphone like they do on the cops do, you know, click, hello, testing, 1, 2, 3, unclick. And he got a phone call from Sheila, his wife, and he could hear it over the radio, and I answered it, of course, and Sheila is, Paul with you? I said, yeah, he is. And I handed him the thing there. And so here's what, now, the listeners aren't going to get this, but right. You will. So I hand it to him, and I says, it's Sheila. So he takes it, and he goes, hi, Sheila. He put the microphone to his ear like it was a telephone.
Yeah.
And we laughed about that. But I remember also the saying was, 50% of the people on the Carleton campus were really happy that he won the Senate. The other 50% were ecstatic. What a great guy, though. I remember at Clinton,
memorable.
When Clinton addressed Carleton College his last year in office, Paul was there, and we were broadcasting it live, and he was walking by our makeshift studio, and hey, Paul, and he'd come over, and he was hurting so bad. He had a bad back.
He suffered
a lot. Senator David Durenberger is my guest this morning on KYMN Radio, and I got so many questions that we're not going to be able to do it all in 45 minutes, so I am already inviting you to come back.
Sure.
Because there's a lot of things I want to ask you, and I'm going to do that right after we take a brief time out here on KYMN Radio and come back with the Senator and ask some questions that you will be interested in. I know you're not interested into my second hour theme song by the Beatles, When I'm 64, but I do know that you are probably interested in knowing this.
I love Grandpa's new home. There's so much to do. That's right. Millstream Commons helps improve the lives of seniors through all kinds of fun activities. Personalized care from a dedicated and well-trained staff, amazing creative meals prepared fresh every day and served in a social setting, live-to-be-healthy fitness classes, private apartments with all the amenities of home, and a place to continue your relationships with family and loved ones. Millstream Commons, your vibrant life continues here.
Hey, this is Dave Esledal of Northfield Outdoors. When shopping this holiday season, remember Denison Meat Locker. Pick up your pork chops and roast, beef roast and steaks, and find several varieties of brats and beef sticks. Great for those stocking stuffers. All meat is hormone and antibiotic free. Denison Meat Locker is a small business that strives for 100% satisfaction with large and small orders. Check out DenisonMeatLocker.com for pricing, and remember Denison Meat Market for all of your processing needs.
The staff at Nikolai Repair in Hampton would like to wish everyone a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Thanks for your patronage, and they look forward to serving you next year. Nikolai Repair in Hampton handles name brand snowblowers, chainsaws, used equipment, and has a great service department. Nikolai Repair has just received a new shipment of Simplicity snowblowers, just in time.
Buy a Simplicity snowblower from Nikolai Repair before the end of 2018, and you'll receive a cash gift card.
We're back live and in color from our studios in beautiful downtown Northfield, Minnesota, on KYMN, AM Radio, 1080 on your dial, for over 50 years, and now 95.1 FM, the one. Senator David Durenberger is my guest this morning. I want to clear something up. It is proper to address former senators, former governors, former presidents, former congressmen as if that title was still
title,
in place.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right, yeah.
So you are introduced as Senator David Durenberger,
right.
Not former senator.
Right.
Yeah. I just want to make sure I'm doing
Oh,
doing
no, you're doing
right.
Just fine. You can do anything. I mean, we know each other well enough.
Yeah.
Just call me Dave.
Well, if I know you that well, I can ask you, as a liberal Republican, would you describe yourself as that?
Progressive.
Progressive. Well, I should write that down.
Yeah.
Okay. As a progressive Republican, might as well get right to the meat of it, and that is, what do you think about the administration, the president of the United States of America?
Unprintable. Or unspeakable. He's the accident that had to happen to the Republican Party as it went off the rails, and nationally and in the state as well. This is a Republican Party that in many states was a progressive party, including in Minnesota, and for 60 years. That's why I wrote this book on the subject with Laurie Sturtevant. But the reality is that once it became a national party, remember, we had 20 years calling it the Independent Republican Party of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. We sent we as a nation sent in 1981 we sent 17 progressive Republican senators to the United States Senate to make a total of 54 Republican senators, which is one of the reasons. And the reading of this book will help you understand what I'm talking about in the detail, but. Why Ronald Reagan and George Bush, his vice president, and then President George H.W. Bush, were successful as they were. Because the progressive middle of America is probably about two-thirds of the country. If you take away, you know, the name Republican from the half of that two-thirds, you know, and move it to the right and give it a no new tax label or a overrule Roe v. Wade label or anti-immigration label or whatever it is, and you require all Republicans to either salute that, you know, one of those three or all three of them or whatever it may be at the time, you've lost the heart of what has been traditionally a Republican Party in Minnesota and in other parts of the country. So, and in the nation. And what you've lost is the ability to so-called reach across the aisle of America. And America has an increasingly broad aisle to reach across. It didn't when I got there. When Rudy and I got there? No, we were much closer. There were the Democrats from the South, like my new chairman. I was a brand new member of the Senate Finance Committee, the Tax Writing Committee, Social Security, Health Care, Trade, all those big, big issues. My chairman was Russell Long of Louisiana. And while we differed on things like energy policy, because all his people did was produce it and all mine did was consume it at that time, as he told me once, we were much more alike when it came to what's best for the people of the country. You know, and you could, 'cause you could reach across different parts of the country to reflect what the public needed and how it was expressed in political terms. The founders knew that because they came each from a different colony. And all of those colonists, this is what Russell told me when I got there, each of those colonies came here for a different reason. And people of like reason settled Pennsylvania or Maryland or Virginia or, you know, whatever the case may be. And those values that brought them here were going to follow their successors across the country. The people who founded the country, wrote the Constitution, understood that well enough so that they created two bodies. One was the public opinion body called the House of Representatives. It was up every 2 years. The other was called the Senate. And they provided from the beginning for only two senators from each state so that when every state was heard from, this is what Russell told me, when every state is heard from, you get good national policy. And what has happened to the Republican Party in the last 25 years as it moved to this single issue right is they have taken away the value, that value that was came to this country that was more conservative in a political sense and, you know, they basically destroyed it. And so they end up getting a guy walked down with, you know, golden staircase back in June of 2015, saying, what, I'm going to drain the swamp, right?
Yes, he did
and
say that.
That's what he's doing. He's, but the swamp that he's draining basically is a party that had moved so far to its right, to say nothing of the nation's right, you know, that the swamp was growing. The swamp that everybody complained about was growing, and they were part of the problem. So that's why Trump, in an odd sort of way, is a means to an end, and we're going to use that. I mean, we're using that right now. We used it just a couple of weeks ago in the last election, you know, to change Republicans. Yeah. And there's the 3rd District of Minnesota is a good example, you know, where a Democrat won the 3rd District for the first time in God knows how long. You know, by beating a Republican who's an otherwise good person.
You're talking about Jason Lewis?
No, I'm talking about second. Yeah. About Dean Paulson beating, Dean Phillips beating Eric Paulson.
Yeah, wasn't that something?
Yeah, it seems like a big surprise, but if you look underneath it and you look at what's going on, people in Minnesota say, "Wait a minute, no, this was not the real Eric Paulson that was showing up in the elections." Nor is it the one, apparently, that we're sending to Washington. And it was a matter of survival, if you will, for someone like Eric in today's Washington, D.C., that was driving him. But as far as his constituents were concerned, he wasn't representing them. And it wasn't just that he wasn't representing Democrats,
well,
Republicans as well.
I obviously, you enjoy and understand and comprehend and election process, but I thought that Paulson's attack on Phillips, consistently attacking and going back and picking up things here and there, it was such a negative thing. I thought that perhaps that's why Phillips won, is because people got sick and tired about somebody else telling them how terrible he is. Mm-hmm. Can that apply to Trump?
No, you've got it, and But negative works in campaigns, or they wouldn't.
Well,
do
they
it.
Do it. Yeah,
yeah, they do it. But that sign coming from Minnesota, you know, and this happened in other parts of the country. No, it doesn't work anymore. Negative doesn't work. It shouldn't work. Why? Because it doesn't offer us. It doesn't tell us what can we count on you to do when you get there, other than whatever the so-called party line might be. And people eventually see through all of this, and it's the good, that's the good news. And so they use Donald Trump to clean house, you know, whatever you might call it. And in a sense, in a mental sense, he's cleaning the house, you know, that the Republicans of the last 20, 25 years were building in Washington, D.C. And that, so the end result of this, I don't even believe he's going to run for re-election, but assuming he does, I'm quite confident that he's not going to win re-election. And I don't know whether Republican or Democrat will win. For what I do know, it's going to have to be somebody that's a lot closer to this so-called center, or the progressive center of either party, than they seem to represent. But the reality is, Republicans have learned a lesson. And you begin to feel it today in Washington, D.C., as the reluctance to grab on to the stuff that Trump's talking about, you know, the wall, or the this or the that, you know, all the simple answers. They used to work. For two years they worked. Not anymore.
Do you think that, can you think of any man in your lifetime or woman that has been persecuted, I'll use that word, so we all understand it, as much as this individual in Donald Trump? I mean, the meanness and the efforts to disown him is so unrelenting. And I don't care if you're a Democrat or progressive or Republican, whatever. It's mean. It's just mean, and it's piling up. And it's like, I don't like that, and I agree with you. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he'll even run after. He doesn't have to take all of that.
Yeah, it's.
Don't you agree? It's.
Well, no, I agree that people have been on his case, but I also agree that all they're doing is adapting his style. You know, if Donald Trump is known for anything, it's take you down. If he doesn't agree with you, he'll just take you down. And he does
like
that.
North Korea?
Well, no, like
China.
Like anybody that disagrees with him, he'll have something nasty to say about him. Start with Dirty Hillary, yeah, or whatever he called her.
Yeah, liar.
Start with this guy circling around behind her, you know, yeah, during the debate.
Yep.
I mean, this man deserves what he's getting, whether the prosecution is, you know, going to end up with anything, or the insistence, you know, that they show his tax returns or whatever it is, you know, or everything else that's happening to him in the media included. He's taken away so much from so many people himself that he deserves all that stuff.
Well, and like I say, this is a liberal community, mm-hmm, and I'm conservative, as you know, mm-hmm, and I'm just saying that how many people would be tough enough to take all of that horrible criticism from his children, grandchildren, wife, family, fellow Republicans, and all that? I mean, I couldn't stand up under all that pressure at all.
Mm-hmm. So how about this first ever African-American president gets elected in 2008, and takes office in 2009. And in the face of he called 150 representatives of every phase of the healthcare industry to the White House, spent a day with them, told them what he was going to do, and told them that they were going to have to make a financial contribution of some kind to getting towards as close to the universal coverage in affordable health care as we could possibly get through health reform. And every single one of them walked out of the White House at the end of that day committed to change something they're doing differently to help the president succeed. First time that's ever happened. Within months, the Republican leader of the Congress of the United States declared their objective was to make President Obama a one-term president. And they took down, over the next 9 months, they made it impossible to pass a better Obamacare, you know, than it ended up being. They took it away from him. Even in the Senate, the last bastion of people talking to each other in December, they just folded their tents because the political pressure was, don't give them a thing, and we can beat them. The same thing we did to Clinton. You know, if you want to make him a one-term president, take away his prize. And in that case, it was also health reform. So that's a different form of picking on people, you know, than you're talking about, I know. But if you start right off the bat and you think about the president representing the American people, you know, give him a break. Quit picking on him, you're saying. Quit investigating him. Quit demanding this, that, and the other thing. And I'm just saying there's a different form of penalizing a president, which ends up penalizing us, the people. And I gave you the Obama example as an example of it.
First time I ever heard Obama speak, I went, wow, that guy is really good, a good orator. Mm-hmm. And I'll also say to you, I wish that Trump would start acting presidential. Mm-hmm. In other words, have some humbleness, you know. And it's dividing the nation, you know. I mean, I quite frankly, how close do you think we are to having some sort of a revolution, minimal or maximum, whatever, in regards to your experience during the Korean War and the Vietnam War and Iran and Iraq and all that. The unrest is just, it reminds me of the 60s.
You know, I agree with you, Wayne, and it was up until the election, it was kept getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. But that election was almost, I shouldn't use this phrase, but magical, you know. It said, we, the people of the United States, are not comfortable being who we appear to be, red versus blue. In our families, we can't talk about politics anymore. In all of our other relationships, you don't dare do this. Even on the radio, you know, I'll bet Wayne Eddy had to be a little more subtle in the way he presented things. My friend Bill Doherty, the psychologist from the University of Minnesota, created this Blue Angels and Red Angels. I mean, groups of people coming together and talking about it. And he told me just on Sunday after a church service, he said, guess what? I had 20 Democrat or DFL state legislators together to talk about reaching across the aisle. And he said, I'm now got arrangements for an equal number of Republicans to do the same thing. And then eventually we'll probably get them together. So I'm telling you that because what we saw the first 2 years of the Trump administration is not who we are. Some people may look comfortable with it because they flood their face pages with blue crap or red crap or whatever the case may be. Even the word progressive has been used for the extreme liberals now, you know. They took it away from us and made it hard for people to reach across the aisle or whatever. But that changed. That changed because we changed. We began to change. I'm not going to say we're all changed. We began to change. And you're going to see that evolve as you watch it in particular over the next 2 years as we approach the election. It won't be just all about Trump or anything like that. It's going to be deeper than that. And it's going to be deeper than blue versus red. It's going to be more about, the things you've been talking about in terms of what do we expect of leadership in this country, not just the president, but this new governor of ours, for example, or state legislators, or members of Congress, or county commissioners, or mayors, or anybody that we trust to do what we can't or aren't willing to do ourselves.
You know, this Wallace, I'm comfortable with him.
Mm-hmm.
I am.
Sure, you should be.
And, of course, Jeff Johnson is my boss and owns a radio station, and then there's the Jeff Johnson that lost the election.
Yes, I wondered about that. Yes.
It's 25 minutes before 11 o'clock, and Senator Dave Durenberger is my guest this morning, and I got the big one coming up. By that, I mean a question. Stick around.
Residential or commercial, Cannon Valley Water in Dundas is the place to call for water. Whether it's a complete water conditioning system or just salt delivery and filters, Cannon Valley Water can take care of it. And Cannon Valley Water can also deliver Candy Yohai premium water right to your house or business at great rates, too. Chippewa Springs is as pure today as it was when we first tested it over a century ago and is proudly distributed by Cannon Valley Water. Pickups are now located at 609 Stafford Lane in Dundas, just behind Aldi. Call Cannon Valley for your water today.
Family Fair, Northfield's newly remodeled grocery store downtown, has a new name, a fresh look, and new options. Tortilla chips that are fried in-store, or the deli soup bar with three different soups each day, and the expanded gourmet cheese selection. Stop in, grab the weekly ad, get a Starbucks, get what you need, and be on your way in minutes. Family Fair, your local neighborhood market that provides real values for real people in real communities, right here on Division Street.
We took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans, and we caught the bloody British in a town in New Orleans. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
Of course, when that was popular, it was number two in 1959, Johnny Horton and the Battle of New Orleans. And since cable television came along, and they have the History Channel, the Discovery Channel, the Smithsonian Channel, and the education that you get about, they were in 1959, they were singing songs about it.
Yes.
And now you go, oh, that's what was going on. Holy cow, that was quite a deal. Dave Durenberger is my guest, Senator Dave Durenberger. And, of course, here's the big one. Are you ready? Here we go. Immigration.
Mm-hmm.
Tijuana. The wall. The politics.
Yes. Is that a question?
Yeah. I
all
mean,
right.
Your opinion.
Yes. Thank you. Here's my observation. And I've been asked that question before, so you're going to get the same answer I've given before, which is immigration is a tough issue because the people that value immigration the most are those who are probably the most conservative. They're right down along the border from Arizona to New Mexico to Texas and so forth. And but they can't say that politically. They can't speak to it. So what do we do in the Senate on my watch?
Why can't they?
Well, because they got cheap labor.
Okay.
And politically.
So why didn't you mention California?
Well, that's, you could get, there's part of California too, I'm
sure. Well, that's the big one.
Yeah, but well, no, Texas. that's exactly right. The point being that, people who are differently situated all over America, just in terms of immigration. Mm-hmm. And it's a difficult subject to deal with. So we delegated instinctively without speaking to it. We delegated that to the chairman in the Senate of each of the appropriate committees, the chairman and the ranking Republican or the ranking Democrat, depending on who's in the majority. So it was usually Ted Kennedy's committee on when the Democrats were in power with Al Simpson, my buddy from Wyoming, as the ranking Republican. And we said, you guys go to it over the next 5 years, you know, which is the time that the authority is there's authority for immigration to create changes in the policy. And whatever they came up with, basically we supported. Because starting to take that apart was just, it was the puzzle was going to fall apart. You'd never get it put together. That was tradition. When we had a bipartisan approach to it, that was tradition. In addition to that, and important for Minnesota, is refugees. As you know better than a lot of people, we spent 60, 70 years in our history of our country worrying about the Russians in every country, you know, that had a revolution going on, an independence revolution, starting in Iran, going to South America, Cuba, you know, you name it, ending up in Vietnam, of course, was the last and the more famous one. So we end up, when those wars end, with a lot of refugees. And in addition to that, there's refugees from other things. There's like, we went to Somalia to save 1 million people a year from starvation because a warlord by the name of Adid, you know, was taking all the food that came in, you know, and selling it himself in marketplace. And the people were starving. So George H.W. Bush and Jim Baker decided, we're going to send the Marines to Mogadishu and find this guy. They didn't find him. And I got a whole story that involves me and the president of Eritrea that tells you how they actually found him after Black Hawk Down in Mogadishu. But As a result, there's what now, 75,000 to 80,000 Somali refugees just in Minnesota alone, right?
We have a large contingent in Faribault.
Sure,
and Rice County.
Yes, and most of us are welcome. Once we get used to it, you know, we are welcoming, whether it's immigrants or refugees, we are welcoming as long as there is the capacity to absorb them into the economy of our communities. So immigration hasn't been a big issue, even though the policy, you know, was constructed the way we constructed it in the past, including what do you do about refugees? And now it's been made an issue. How did it get made an issue? By people in politics like the current president of the United States.
I thought it was MS-13.
Well, that's exactly what I mean. It, you know, MS-13 is bad, and you can pin them down, and so are, you know, so are a lot of, you can find this sort of thing if you look for it almost anywhere. But for a couple hundred years, we've been absorbing all of this and their behaviors and so forth. What we need in the country now, obviously, is, you know, to take the partisan shackles off of immigration policy once again, you know, and let the ranking people in and the majority and the minority people in the House and the Senate deal with rational policy. Having politicized it, it's going to go the way of Obamacare on health reform.
I have a question that a lot of people, I think, wonder the same thing, and that is, why does a committee chairman have so much power that he can stop something all by him or herself?
It's the nature of the institution that allows that to happen. When the institution is a bipartisan institution, it can't happen, and it doesn't happen. Because all of the differences that may be political as well as policy get ironed out in a committee. And again, in this book, I tell the story of how George H.W. Bush gets to be so remembered as the president who signed the Americans with Disabilities Act, who signed the Clean Air Act, who signed the Civil Rights Restoration Act. And there's some other things that are less well known. How did that happen? Because he had a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House. How in the world could this happen? Was it some magician or something like that? No. It was the Democratic leader of the United States Senate who realized in advance that if you let bills like those go from the Senate to the House, they're going to be made more liberal in the House and impossible for a Republican president to sign. And if you believe in the rights of people with disabilities, you believe in the climate change and clean air and whatever it may be, you believe in restoring civil rights across this nation to all kinds of people, then it's worth a lot to have a Republican president sign that legislation. So George Mitchell called us into his office. There were always two or three Republicans, two or three Democrats. I happen to be on all three of those that I mentioned. Into his office. And we, in the Senate, on the Senate side, we negotiated among ourselves and with the White House. We negotiated the content of that bill before it went to the Senate, to the floor of the Senate. So that when it passed, then we went to conference with the House. And we fought to preserve as much as we could so that George H.W. Bush was able to sign the bill, and it would be. That's the definition of bipartisanship. That's the definition of bipartisan leaders. Howard Baker, Bob Dole, George Mitchell. And that's the definition of the country that America wish we could get back to.
Dave Durenberger, the senator. Dave Durenberger is my guest here on the Wayne Eddy Affair. And David, Senator.
Yes.
Think about this, if you will. And I'll take a brief break. And my question is, well, let's take the break and I'll put it in form that I understand.
If you're looking for a last-minute gift idea, check out Burkhart's Myers Shoes in downtown Faribault for useful Christmas gifts such as long shoehorns, shoeshine kits, Yak Track ice grippers, smart wool socks, and sheepskin-lined slippers and moccasins for both men and women. While you're in, Check out the Ladies Winter Shoe Clearance Sale with over 600 pair of ladies' shoes and boots, all sale priced and now out on tables. All of us here at Burkhart's Meyer Shoes wish you and yours a most joyous Christmas holiday.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year from Grundhofer and Ludischer and Marv, David, Jennifer, Robin, Melanie, Alyssa, Marlis, and Jean. For some of you, this holiday season might be less merry and happy because of a legal problem. Fortunately, there is help. Northfield has many good lawyers. At Grundhofer and Ludischer, we promise to give you personal attention and peace of mind so you can enjoy your holiday season and the new year. Ho, ho, ho!
We're back live and in color on the Wayne Eddy Affair. I don't know why I don't why I brought that phone in the studio, but anyhow, I'm not going to answer it. At 13 minutes before 11 o'clock, Senator Dave Nuremberger is my guest here this morning on Kim, a friend you can count on. And there are a lot of questions that I want to ask, and we're limited to the next 13 minutes. And I did want to have you have an opportunity to... Now, you were a professor at St. Thomas?
Yes.
You taught a class in politics?
No, it was health policy.
Health policy?
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In an MBA program at the Opus College of Business.
And the reason that you were qualified to teach that particular subject?
That was one of my specialties in the United States Senate, and okay, working on health reform policy.
I'm telling the audience.
And, right.
Well, do you remember the when Mrs. Clinton was assigned to be the leader of that effort back in,
was it the 1993.
And a big bunch of arguing that went over that, and the president's wife is running the show.
Mm-hmm.
That was, where were you at that time?
Well, I was in the Senate. I was the chairman, the ranking member that year of the committee, and I spent 2 years from 93 and 94, largely in Senator John Chafee's hideaway, we call him, the little office in the most of us had in the Capitol, working with up to 27 senators was the maximum number we got to. Started out with about 15 of us, we got up to 27, equally divided practically between Democrats and Republicans. Our job for that period of time was to save Mrs. Clinton from her own bill and from Republicans, starting with Newt Gingrich in the House and Phil Graham in the Senate, who wanted no bill passed. It was going to be their means of defeating President Clinton to get no health care passed, the same thing they did to Obama later. And so we spent our time at breakfast talking about finding the middle ground between them. And that was, each of us had some background and expertise on a committee, and John Chafee and I and a couple of other people who had spent our time on the Senate Finance Committee creating reform legislation in the past were the keys to finding this so-called middle ground. And unfortunately, Mrs. Clinton didn't budge. The Republicans, you know, that opposed her, they wouldn't budge. And finally, when we put our, you know, we tried negotiating with both sides, and we ended up like in August of 1994 saying, here's what we propose, you know. And by that time, George Mitchell just called us in and said, guys, you know, we haven't got the votes. We've got the Senate is so divided right now, and so is the House. We don't have the votes for it.
How close was Obamacare to what Hillary Clinton was proposing?
It was, it went beyond, it was, they tell me that they used what we had worked up as a sort of a base that they were to operate from. But they took it the next step farther, which is, towards universal coverage. We weren't going to a universal coverage bill or something like that. We were trying to get costs under control by changing the way we paid for healthcare. So, but what happened in the Obamacare is they blended the two of them together, both the changes in the system and the way we pay for it and expanding it. That happened in the on Obamacare.
Okay, I'm switching subject here, and we kind of touched on it. Two senators for 50 states, and then, of course, representatives based on population. And I remember going to your office several times, and we were assigned individuals to go visit, our representatives and our senators. And coming back on the plane, the guy from North Dakota, the broadcaster from North Dakota, wasn't busy at all. I mean, he had like two senators and one representative or something like that. And then California, on the other hand, has two senators and a potload of not to use that word. Yeah. Oh, maybe.
Something in the 60s, probably.
Yeah. And there was something brought up about California believing it was unfair that they only get two senators with the population compared to Wyoming or North Dakota or Rhode Island or whatever. Do you think that will ever change, that they would allow more senators from New York and from California?
No, just quoting my friend Russell Long, as I did a little bit earlier, to the effect that if you want to just test public opinion every couple of years, you know, you do that. You turn the Senate into the House, and then you've got a big House.
Okay.
Right? So the idea was that every state have a voice, because every one of these states is different. Yes, we are similar to Wisconsin. We are similar to Oregon or Washington or Rhode Island or Maine or some places like that. Yes, we're very similar, but we're not identical, you know. And so giving the immigrants who came to this country as immigrants, refugees, whatever it is, over a period of time and settled in one or the other of these states, or people who just move from one state to the other, there are certain things that are contagious about a place like Minnesota, including the weather and the mosquitoes and whatnot. But you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know, just like you can't pick up Minnesota and put it down anywhere else other than in Minnesota.
Yep.
And that's the value of the United States of America.
Did you ever get treated like a flyover?
No. Did I?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so, because in the Senate, when there are only two from every state, you get treated like you're one of the most important people in the world, because, in effect, a senator is.
Yeah. What is it called? The exclusive club of the world?
Yeah, whatever the name, it isn't the exclusivity. It's the fact that you bring from one of these 50 states, you bring the uniqueness of what they do in their legislatures, in their counties, in their cities, in their townships, you know, and in their institutions like higher education or religion or whatever the case may be. You bring that set of experiences and values to Washington, D.C., and it mixes with everybody else's, and you get national policy.
Well, Senator, I have to take a final break this hour, and we'll only have about 5 minutes left, and I got two things I want to ask you that are uplifting. Not uplifting, but not so serious, all right? And we can get back to that stuff next time you have an opportunity to come down. We will be back in just 48 seconds.
Santa here, coming to you from the campus of Northfield Retirement Community, where the elves are gearing up for a wonderful holiday season filled with good food, music, and cheer. And to remind you, the best gifts don't always come down the chimney with me, but are the heartfelt smiles and laughter shared by family, residents, and staff. From our NRC family to yours, we wish you a happy and healthy Merry Christmas. Northfield Retirement Community. Innovation, choice, tradition.
10:54:49, and at 11 o'clock we'll have 15 with the author. Terry Knight has a pretty interesting, of course she always does, each Monday at 11.
Your friends at Coldwell Banker South Metro thank you and wish you a very happy holiday season. May the new year bring you an abundance of health, happiness, and prosperity. All the season's best to each and every one of you from the management and staff at Coldwell Banker South Metro.
Senator Dave Durnberger is my guest here this morning on the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN. Two things I want to do, and they're on the lighter side. First of all, do you have any connection to Northfield? It amazes me how many people have, like George Latimer has a friend that lives in the Northfield Manor.
Yeah.
Do you have any connection to Northfield?
Well, I have. There's a variety of people here that I've come to know over the years, and I don't want to start mentioning them
for fear of
leaving somebody off the list. Okay. Right?
And of course, the next one, Terry Knight did not hear this story. We may have shared it in the past, and that's when I was in, I think I might have been president of the Broadcast Association. I remember when you came late and Skip Humphrey. I thought that was funny. Whoa. Remember that?
Yes.
Anyhow, that's a different story.
Yeah.
The one where I met you for breakfast at the Capitol,
mm-hmm.
and we went to the senator's only elevator.
Okay. You remember that?
Yeah. And mm-hmm. and so you and I are walking, waiting for the elevator. It opens up, and there is Senator Ted Kennedy. With his tie loose and his neck is about a 19 neck. And you said, Senator Kennedy, I want you to meet my friend Wayne Eddy from Northfield, Minnesota. Dwayne Eddy? Wow, how are you? And then he started going, boom, boom.
Yeah, right.
And we're doing, boom, 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 all the way up. And then I wanted, we sat down for breakfast, not with Mr. Kennedy, but Senator Kennedy. But I said to you, I said, you know, I said to myself, if I meet this man, I'm going to talk about Chappaquiddick.
Mm-hmm.
And then then I decided that on the elevator, maybe this isn't a place to do it. And you said, very good protocol, Wayne.
Right.
And so I never
good got memory, too, Wayne.
Oh, yeah. Good. Oh, yeah. That was funny. I mean, that was really funny. But at 3 minutes before 11 o'clock on Kim Terry Knight coming up on that, what is the name of your book? We'll get to get together with Terry.
Yeah, let's do it this spring.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is the name of the book in the crux?
When Republicans Were Progressive. And it's the story of the time from 1938 until Jesse Ventura gets elected in 98 of a Republican Party that actually represented the best in Minnesota. And it's in the middle of that I, you know, got to be executive secretary to Harold Evander, got involved and worked for Elmer Anderson, and then had three chapters are devoted to the time in the United States Senate, and then the last chapter is a sort of a set of recommendations for how do we change the system. But I was blessed with having Laurie Sturdivant, who's retiring this end of this week from the Minneapolis Tribune, help me write it, because I laughingly say it would have been a 500-page book instead of a 296-page book if she hadn't been the writer that helped me make it work.
Well, I'll let Terry do an interview with you, but anyhow, is that available on
You can get it on Amazon. You can get it in most bookstores. And
we have a bookstore here in Northfield.
Yeah, they probably would have it. I would hope they would
have it.
Maybe
if not, have a signing when you come down.
Sure, love to.
You know, do my show, do Terry's show, then go have lunch, and then do a signing.
Okay.
You know,
I'm going
to
do it.
I'll have to have Terry arrange that.
Sure.
All right. So have you had a nice conversation with Arne Carlson lately?
Yes, I've had good conversations with Arne, I seem to get along with just about everybody now that I'm 84 years old and retired and
you're
so
84.
Forth. And I'm, you know, right now I'm spending my time trying to be helpful to Tim Walz and it's just working great. He's the real deal.
You wear a label then?
Oh, I will always be a Republican. Okay. You know, I'm what I like to call a progressive Republican.
Okay.
Because that's the period that I represented in Minnesota history.
You're 87?
84.
84.
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
Much younger.
Well, you have hair.
You're a little bit.
And trim.
I try to work on it, take care of myself.
You have your faculties?
Yes, most of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I got a new heart valve. Other than that, I'm doing fine.
Well, I'm going to say hello to Jim Wycor for you.
Would you please?
Yeah. And he's 87 and down in Arizona for the winter.
I wish I had a business card. I'd give it. I know I'm not in business. I'm retired. But tell him to call me. My brother knows my phone number.
Okay. And point number seven, when you do come back, I would like to know if you could educate us in regards to the money game in politics. Because I've heard that the minute you get in, you spend 2-3 hours a day calling people, asking for money.
Mm-hmm. And that didn't happen to me, but it has happened since then.
Okay. We will say thank you. And tomorrow morning, I'm going to be talking to a woman that I think was a mountain climber, and now she's... She is one of those people that I need, and she's going to come in and talk about her mountain climbing duties, and she is a prosthetist. I put that into Google one time, the microphone. What is a prosthetist, or something like, or no, I sent a text message.
Yeah.
I'm going to be going to my prosthetist.
Right.
And it's sent out, I'm going to my prostitute.
Yes, I can hear that coming.
All right. This is the one. Thank you, Senator Durenberger.
Thank you, Wayne Eddy.
Okay. KYMN, Northfield, Minnesota, 1080 on your AM dial, 95.1 FM, the one from downtown beautiful Northfield, Minnesota.
It's time for 15 with the Author, hosted by Terry Knight. Join Terry as she opens the cover on a different book each week and talks with the author about their book, their life, and their message. Take a deeper look under the cover with Terry.